All right, welcome Wander family to another episode. Today we're featuring Wander's lead strategist, Mariana Lopez, on our show. She has over 10 years of experience in building product, working on user research, usability, and interaction design in web and mobile applications. Mariana has a master's from Carnegie Mellon for human-computer interaction and has also taught as a university professor on human-computer interaction and research. She is currently working on one of Wander's long-term clients, Loop Commerce, which was recently acquired by Synchrony Bank. So welcome, Mariana, to the show.
Hi, Jamie. It's great to be here. Excited to talk a little bit about what we are working on and some of the challenges we face day to day.
Awesome. We're excited to have you here. And as always, we're going to start our interview with a quick round of rapid fire questions. So here we go. Mariana, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Costa Rica. I am born and raised there all my life, all the way through my first degree in computer science. And then that was the first time I moved outside, was to do my master's in Carnegie Mellon in human computer interaction.
Amazing. I mean, if you're from Costa Rica, why would you want to leave, right? It's such a beautiful country.
It is wonderful.
And where are you now?
I am currently in Atlanta, living in the Georgia Tech graduate student facility because my husband is getting a master's now.
Amazing. That's a fun state to be in. And what's a book that you think everyone should read?
There are so many, but currently, and related to what I'm talking about today, is a book called Outcomes Versus Outputs by Josh Sheedon.
Amazing. Let's dive into that a little bit further later in the podcast. What is one app you cannot live without?
again, so many, but I think for me, it's WhatsApp. So we use that for messaging a lot back in Costa Rica, and it's, especially being far away, it's, you know, my line, my invisible string to my family, my connection to my friends. So definitely it's the one I can't live without.
So you never switched over to Telegram or Signal when that big privacy thing came out with Facebook?
We did, and I had like a lot of groups like being created and ported over, but gradually everybody just came back to WhatsApp.
Awesome. Okay, so what do you think is the best invention of all time besides WhatsApp?
I don't think that's the best invention of all time. That's a really hard question, but for me, I think it would be the incubator for babies. I think that's the best invention of all times, just because I had to use it when my little girl was born, and just modern technology, you know, making us be able to have a better quality of life and sometimes even life if we wouldn't have been able to. So for me, those are the best inventions, really.
Wait, so what is an incubator? I don't have kids, so I don't know what that is.
Abby was born a little bit premature, and she had to be put in like a machine that kept her warm. And she even had like a little halo in her incubator to help her breathe. So,
gotcha. Okay. Of course. And what's your favorite, what's your all-time favorite accomplishment?
Oh, wow. That is also hard. I think when I was living back home, I started a small UX consulting firm, and you know, being able to bring that field into Costa Rica, which was really new, and being able to, you know, not only me but also hire other designers and share that knowledge and build a little bit of that with our clients as well. I think that's one of the proudest that I've been.
And definitely a proud moment too. It's not an easy task to be able to bring in clients and hire teams. So definitely something to celebrate about. And what is the biggest challenge you're working on right now?
So right now with Loop Commerce, or GiftNow as we call it, we're working on just strategy and making sure that we think about how can we enhance the current experience and how can we build out better and future experiences. And the challenge comes from that, right? In the companies that I worked with and the clients that we worked with, it's very product or feature driven. And so often you'll hear, this is it, I got the new thing that we have to build out into the product. And it can vary all the way from, we need to integrate with a different checkout provider, all the way to, we need to build a whole other different flow. And often these ideas are awesome and they're great, but they come from top down and they come from people hearing buzz or competitors or even some of our partners asking for things. And sometimes you forget that this is a product that people are using, that people like, and that there's things closer to home that we could change, that we could do, that would really enhance their experience and enhance the way they are using the products. And so it's that tension between like product and feature led, and being able to drive innovation more from research and from real opportunities and pain points that are happening right now out in the field. And not only that, but being able to change that mentality into doing continuous discovery and having users be one of those prongs in what makes you innovate and what inspires change. So the challenge there is really, how do you balance and how do you become a little bit more focused on the outcome that you want to achieve instead of just like output, making sure that developers are always working on something or the designers are always working on something.
Yeah, and that's a good way to tie in the book you mentioned, which is Outcome versus Output. So dive in a little bit deeper into that. So how are you balancing the outcome versus output with your current client Loop Commerce or GiftNow?
Right. And so we and this is new. We're still in the mix and still having like a little bit of growing pains and exploration and learning. So what we're trying to do is balance a little bit of exploratory research with ideas and concepts that have been out there in the Loop world, that things that they want to get built. And so we're trying to match some of the pain points that we see and figure out, well, do these ideas, are they still valid? Is it what currently our users are feeling? And try to make sure that we are, you know, taking into consideration all this learnings that we're having and also trying to find a way to validate some of the hypotheses that have existed for a while in the product context that we have. And the way that we've set this up is we have something that has been established as like product trios. And so that will be sort of
What is product trios?
Yeah, product trios we call them. So it's like the project manager, design and UX, and development. And so a representative from each of these teams, they have like weekly meetings, and we come up with like, okay, this is going to be our focus. This is going to be our hypothesis for the next, you know, 2-3 sprints, and let's go out there and let's test it. And so we do a good mix of exploratory research, and we go out, we do interviews with a focus, and then we report back on them, and hopefully nothing too elaborate, more like continuously. We have like little cards of like what we learned in that interview, and then we come up with opportunities and we try to map that to a opportunity tree. And from there, we try to figure out, okay, what are our outcomes that could help, that could benefit, you know, both our users and the business. And then we go through a series of concept validation, to see if what we came back with from the interviews really resonates with people. And, there's pitfalls. It hasn't been a smooth process. So while we're doing all of these, like, continuous discovery or product trios, we're also working on, like, the day-to-day, the roadmap that has been established by the company. And so priorities shift. Sometimes we'll meet in the product trio and we'll be like, oh no, nothing happened all week. We weren't able to move forward. And then another thing that happens is, for example, we're currently testing a really cool concept that, you know, I've fallen in love with, the company's falling in love with, but concept validation has, you know, not been resonating that great. And so here we have like a little dichotomy, because we've already like fallen in love with this idea that we've created, and when we're testing it out with users, they're like, yeah, but that's basically the same thing as a gift card. And and you know, that's the opposite from what we want to hear. We want to hear like, ah, this is so innovative. It's like a gift card, but better. And yeah.
I mean, that's always the dilemma, right? It's like, you know, you can fall in love with an idea, especially like as a founder or a product team, and then a lot of times the users don't want what you thought was amazing.
Exactly. And so now the challenge here is, first, is our experiment sound? That we cover all our bases? That we interview the right audience? And second of all, has it covered all like the different scenarios from like what our concept could be? And third, how do we go back to leadership and tell them, hey, this might not have been that great $1 million idea that we thought we had our hands on? And so it's a little bit, it's great. We're changing the process, but it's also a little bit of like a sad start, because the first time that we're doing this, it might be an idea that we kill instead of an idea that, you know, we take all the way through completion. But this is why we're doing it, right? In another universe, we would have built the features, we would have gotten retailers involved, we would have spent a lot of money. Oh, yeah. And then it would have flopped. So yeah. So it's like the good side of what we're doing, but you wanted that first iteration of things that we were doing to have been super successful, and you know, it really wasn't.
Of course. And like, and I've seen so many companies too, where they're not doing these exploratory research and not testing new ideas and features. And they, as you said, they go and roll it out, and they're getting involved. They're getting their partners involved and their vendors involved. And lo and behold, it's not something that their users even wanted. So I'm actually curious, you know, how often are the ideas that are being passed down from top down being implemented because the users actually wanted it, versus the leadership team hearing a buzz and thinking it's a good idea? How often do you see those ideas actually being followed all the way through?
all the time. And not only in Loop, right? Before Loop, I've been there for about a year and a half now, which is a significant amount, but in terms of development life cycle, that's been like two or three ideas. But in other clients as well, right, you would hear, and sometimes in these like complex ecosystems, like it is Loop, you have your users, which are not paying for the service, then you have your retailers, which is the people that are like paying for it, and then you have the product, right? And sometimes retailers or this B2B is what's driving the feature set, and the users are all the worse for it. And you know, Loop is an exciting product which delights people, but before that, I used to work a lot in enterprise creating software for like your work practices. And what would happen is the people that were purchasing the software would want to have processes that would log things, processes that would, you know, have audit trails, And all the time, there were these users all day long, 8 hours a day, that were using software that was really cumbersome to use, that just made their lives worse. And one of the studies that we did when we started doing evaluative research was their software, even though they were like, you know, it doesn't matter if it's bad to use because their employees have to use it, was having so much influence on employee turnover. So it was a service event management system for repairs on trucks, and they were having a huge turnover on mechanics because they were saying like technicians don't want to work on this software, and they would just quit and find a different dealership that didn't do this. And because we were able to convince them to do research, and because we were able to go in and dig and do exit interviews for people that quit, we learned that this software was actually driving people to quit. And that's when the two parties that were forcing our users to use the system started listening and started saying like, maybe we should make this usable. Maybe it's not all about the audit trail. Because as you know, employee turnover right now is like key.
I can't imagine having one software making your employees quit. That must be quit. One bad software.
And so if you think about it, in the end, you know, my goal was to actually make their lives better, but also it eventually aligned with the business perspective because, you know, when we actually did and we went in and we changed some of the processes, maybe not even all the UI, it directly impacted with less rework, less doing things. So people were working more efficiently, and also they weren't quitting. So you never know, right? Sometimes you think like, well, we should always follow where the money is and where we're gonna be able to make more sales. But sometimes there's hidden costs that you don't see. And that's why this being able to talk to the human who's involved in using your product is so important. And on that note, one of the things that we try to balance as well is that new feature, that very exciting concept that I'm working on, that my face lights up and, you know, I work in research and I work in design, I want to do new things, versus that continuous improvement, that small discovery where you sit with people actually using your product and you analyze every single detail and you're like, well, what if we move the button over 1 inch, and what if we change the label here, and what if we did this little flow? So small improvements instead of innovation, and that is less sexy to sell.
Yeah.
Less harder to get product to be able to commit and improve, and also it's harder to see the value because it's not going to generate you more sales. It's maybe going to have a little bit more retention, but in the end, these are the immeasurable costs that you have, because over time, that's what makes a product become stale, and that's what makes a product become old school, because no improvements have been made. And if you're always chasing out that next big feature, sometimes you miss the little improvements that could impact your conversion 100%, right? So one of the recent projects that we were doing is when we send out gifts in Loop, you have the ability to choose how you want to deliver it. You can choose if you want to deliver it via email, or if you want to deliver it via text, or if you want to deliver it printing it out and giving it to the person. And this is all about gifting. And we noticed that people were canceling more often when you were printing things. And so we had this discussion in the trio, and we were like, you know, maybe we just don't let people select print anymore. And I was like, no, let's investigate a little bit. Let's dig deeper. Why are people canceling when they're print? And what we found out was the print version doesn't really have anything other than like, you got a gift. Go find out what your gift is. And so it loses some of like that magic because there's it doesn't have like the item. And a lot of people were using GiftNow because they were very close to the holidays and they didn't have the item, wasn't gonna ship directly to their house in time for like Christmas. And so the print at least was something tangible that they could give to the person. They were like, oh, here's your gift. This is what we want to get you. And when they noticed that it didn't have the picture, they would just cancel. And they were like, no, I'll do something else. And so if we had just gotten if we had just removed the cancel option, we would have potentially lost that use case that's very important for people, which is that last minute gifter. And so we reworked our printouts to include the product image. And those are like the kinds of details that you can sometimes miss if you are just data driven and you don't really go back and ask the whys. So, you know, that enhancement, we had to convince people, hey, it's worth doing instead of, you know, this other big feature. Right.
But it's not the sexy stuff.
It's not the sexy stuff, right? Like, yeah. Changing your printout that you've had for 3 years is—it's not going to get you any new sales.
Yeah. And I think a lot of product managers often forget to think about that. Like, it is sometimes it's about the continuous improvement versus chasing after new features just because it's like, oh, the shiny object. Oh, our competitors are doing it, and I know especially with larger organizations. You get a little bit of that whiplash from the sales team. You know, the sales team is out there talking to the customers and the customers are saying, oh, we want this feature, we want that feature. And then the sales team is coming to the product team and saying, we got to build X, Y, and Z out by next quarter or otherwise we're going to lose this deal. So how do you balance that from like having these ideas being sent from leadership team? Then you have the sales team telling you that the customers want X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, your end users are telling you something else and the end users aren't even the ones paying for it. So where do you even start with something like that?
to be honest, I don't think we have it fully fleshed out. Just yesterday, I was in a change management meeting with product and trying to figure out like how do we take change requests from sales and how do we measure the impact that they're gonna have and how confident we are they're gonna get us the sale and how do we, because sometimes there's two types of sales that come in, right? It's the sale that is the patient client, which we love, which is like, I want this feature, but I'm gonna start using you. So that's easier to handle because that idea just gets pulled into our opportunity tree and mapped into the roadmap. But there's also the sale that says like, until you do this, I'm not gonna use your product. And yeah. Then that needs to bump anything else that you're working on if you wanna make that sale.
And it's not even guaranteed.
No, and it's not even guaranteed. And sometimes we do the work, we've done the work, we pivoted our whole product line to be, we did this thing with gifting. Right now, whenever you get your gift, GiftNow tells you what it is and actually lets you choose, right? So if I get a pink purse, I can change it for a blue purse even before it ships. But this particular retailer wanted you to get the notification and get a surprise, but not tell you what you were getting. So basically changing our whole product offering. And we did a little bit of research. We figured out maybe there was a use case for it. We built it. We implemented it. It was successful, but it wasn't adopted as well as we thought. And people weren't really using it from the retailer side or from our side as much as we had expected. So we're not perfect. It's still happening. I am 100% sure that we have the roadmap for Q2 and Q3. We're doing research for things, and tomorrow something's gonna come up, and we're gonna be swayed. And the tricky thing is, I think, not letting that be the only road that you take, and also documenting some of like the decisions that we've made, why we made them, and being able to retro and say, like, hey, that was a bad call. Why was that a bad call? Did we do enough research? Did we figure out, hey, our product offering is really completely different? And even if we wanted that retailer, it wasn't a good fit. So, you know, there's always learnings. Yeah. And I don't have that answer.
but you brought up a good point about, like, making sure that you're documenting decisions and being able to go back to why those decisions are being made, because a lot of times product companies or product teams are just so much in the day-to-day, and they don't pop their head up to see where are we actually going and why are we going that way. And then two, they don't look back as to reflect on, like, why did we even come this way in the first place, and, like, how can we avoid mistakes moving forward? So I actually wanted to ask, like, because Loop recently got acquired by Synchrony, and there's a lot of new changes and new stakeholders in the equation. So how do you navigate through having so many stakeholders being involved in product? And what is your best advice for anyone who's in that situation?
I'm very shielded by the head of product, who is probably fielding a lot of those.
I feel like you're not giving yourself enough credit, because, you know, from the Wander side, we just hear how invaluable you are to their team, and, you know, that they basically can't operate without you, you know, so you are very important. And I just wanted the audience to know that.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeannie. Yeah, and you do see, like, from time to time, conflicting priorities. One of the interesting things about Loop or GiftNow is it's a gifting service, but it was acquired by a bank, so a lot of our policies for security and for privacy are really strict, and it's sometimes a pain to design around those, but, you know, we're all the better designers for it. So, yeah. At least there, I can totally tell it's, like, you know, bank level security breathing down some of our decisions there.
Yeah, well, explain a little bit further about that. What is it like to build a product with high security, and, like, what are the limitations when you're going about building a new feature or product?
Now, about the first party, how they call it. So it's retailers directly to consumer, but Loop has another branch, which is corporate, and they sell to companies to be able to gift their employees. So they have a portal where you can go in and pick the gifts that you want to gift to, you know, say Wander, and you're like, okay, this is my budget, and so your employees get 3 or 4 options that they can choose from, and then they can pick their gift, enter their own shipping information, and you, as an employer, you don't have to worry about anything. You just had to worry about picking the gifts, which is, you know, really nice. But when we're building that portal, there's things that, you know, you wouldn't expect to have to deal with in a gifting service. So, like, this portal times out after 15 minutes of inactivity. So same like with your bank. But, you know, it's really weird because you're building a gift and all of a sudden it's like, hey, your session's about to expire. And we have, like, these big conversations about, you know, it's a whole different product line. And they're like, no, these are, like, standard requirements of any application that we build. Or, for example, we want to send out reports to corporate to say, like, hey, this is your gifting campaign. This is how many people answered. These are thank you notes that they gave us. And they're like, no, that's personal information. You can't share that over email. It has to be encrypted. It has to be password protected. And I'm like, but I want to put a pretty report out that lets you know, hey, your money was well spent. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, personal information.
Oh, wow. So that's kind of those inhibits, are like
some of the,
it inhibits a bit of the user challenges. Experience.
Yeah. And these are, I worked in banking before. So these are some of the things that, you know, you deal with at a banking level. But if you're not used to that, it's very jarring to have to include that in something that feels a little bit lighter and airier and more delightful in the context of like gifting. All, in the end, it's all the better for clients because everything is more secure and also your data is really protected. But the experience is a little bit trickier, if you get what I mean.
Yeah. So how do you do continuous improvement on something like that?
But there is things. So Marlon, our great and awesome designer, is working on reporting within that tool. So instead of sending out the email, you would have to follow a link and it's password protected, but then the report is going to be really nice and awesome and it's going to have people wanting to log into their portals to see the progress of how their gifts are being delivered. And so, you know, we don't share it out through email, but then our graphics and the interactiveness that you can have on it are going to be amazing.
Gotcha.
Trade-offs. Yeah.
Alternatives.
And so the other thing that we run into, right, is we're building this amazing report, but sometimes we then get pushback from development because now we're trying to make them great in Portal and we're adding in this graphics and these interactive elements, and that's where, you know, the third tension comes in, which is like feasibility and how easy or hard it's going to be to build, and convincing teams to do more than just like the minimum viable product.
Right, because you're always going to have developers wanting to get to what's the easiest and fastest way to deploy a new feature on a product. So where in your trio model, are they part of every conversation you have regarding product development, and like how much, I guess, weight does the development team have on how things are being designed out?
At Loop, a lot. we do have in each product trio a representative of the development team, and they're not involved in all of the product discussions or the design meets that we have later. But one thing that we've learned or that we've started to incorporate is, now that they're part of the trio and they learn the why and they understand like the persona or the user that's behind it, it's a little bit easier to make those arguments. So for example, with the security and trying to figure out the report, they're like, no, we can just send the SIP file that's encrypted and they can just enter a password to see that report. That was the easiest MVP
way of doing
it. Sounds
like a really
bad experience,
though.
It is. And so when they started going to the product trios, we also started involving them in some of the interviews. And they heard the Julia, who's sending out these reports, saying like, yes, and then I have to send out the password in a separate email, and the client always loses it, and so I just get emails saying like, how many gifts have been redeemed, and phone calls, and I'm half of my day just answering those questions because they don't have access to the information. And so when we were back doing discovery, whenever they said like, yeah, but we have that already, we would be able to say like, but you remember that interview and you remember how painful it is. And so being able to, you know, we're all humans and we can all have a little bit of empathy, but if you hear it from somebody else and you have that like real use case, it sort of helps like build that trust within the team too, and everybody wants to work on something that has value. And so I think that developers have started to come around a little bit because they're able to see that we know who our persona is, we know who we're building for, and we have actual use cases of, this is gonna make their life better. This is gonna stop those 20 phone calls a day to be able to get that information. So,
yeah, imagine just spending half your day just answering emails on like how many gifts were being sent out. That's a lot. That's a lot of money being wasted on something that can be automated. What would you say So what advice would you give to any product leaders coming into a typical tech startup where culture is driven by engineers? I think we're starting to see a trend since the pandemic where companies are starting to put more and more focus in user experience design and user research, but that only really came in the last, I would say, 2 to 3 years. So majority of Silicon Valley companies and other tech startups are so much driven by engineering culture. So what advice would you give a product leader coming into a company like that on how they can better balance what engineers want and how do you balance, balancing the engineer decisions versus bringing in the design and design thinking into that culture?
And what I'm gonna say, I've learned the hard way. Whenever I used to go into refinement at Loop, the design team and I would joke because they told me, "Are you wearing your serious shirt? Did you have a
your
good
what?
Meeting or your serious shirt, like your
serious
your, like, suit shirt?" Yeah. And we used to joke and like, did your idea get like pulled apart into pieces or did you get a good reception? And I would have to eat like a pint of ice cream after those meetings because they were rough.
God.
And I can tell you the three things I think worked for me. The first one is learning the product inside out. So I was a newcomer and I had all these ideas on how to change the product and make it better. And being a researcher, I failed at doing research with the team that I was joining. I should have started by knowing every single flow, every single way that the product behaved. Because a lot of those initial discussions, I was saying like, we should do this. And they would say, well, you can't do that because you have donate. And you can't do that because you have to exchange. And you can't do that because some gift cards are set in denominations and some gift cards are flexible. And I didn't know. I had run through the product a couple of times. I'd done a couple of interviews and I was like, oh, that's weird. We could probably change that. And that really bit me. It showed that they were there for a really long time and that I hadn't like grasped what the product was and what the offering was and where the value was. And I think now it's sometimes there's still a flaw or two that I don't know exists, but it's a lot more, you know, thought out. And there's this flow and there's this flow, and I understand everything that has been coded and built into the product. And I'm coming from a place where I understand their users and I understand their offering. And so the recommendations that we make are a little bit more foolproof. The second one is involving development sooner. So whenever we had an idea, you know, I'm very used to the UX process and I would share wireframes with product. I would concept validate with users. But I was used to a world where I would just come in with the solution done and they would give that to developers and they would build it. And the culture here was, you know, why are we doing this? Why is that done? What did you consider this other flow? And so I started sharing earlier with developers and I started sharing them block wireframes and flows and asking them like, is this harder? Is this easier? And the third one is the product trios, involving them in research, getting them closer to our users, making sure they understood the why and the value in things that we were changing. And there are still times where, you know, refinement gets heated, but it's a lot better now. It is definitely something that I think we've come a long way, and I hopefully have met them also halfway in understanding where they're coming from and doing my research and having empathy for the people that are building the products that I love and that I hope our users love as well.
Yeah, so to synthesize,
One, make sure you know the product inside and out so that the dev team doesn't come and bite you. Two, getting the development team involved in ideation pretty early on. And then three, having these, trio?
Trios. Involving them in research and discovery.
Yeah. Getting them involved in research and discovery. So anytime the designers want to get engineers involved in the conversation, it tends to be like one designer per every six engineers on that call. So that can get a little bit intimidating. How do you navigate those kind of conversations? Do you usually ask like a point person to come on board, or do you get the whole engineering team on those conversations? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, so we do have that. We have a lot less designers than we have developers, but we're also, we work a little bit in like pairs. So it'll be UX and design. And so usually two of us from the design team in the meeting. And we have identified, like, in each agile team, one representative that joins us for trios. And so that's gotten easier with some of the conversations. But then also, as we've worked together, I know that some developers handle some areas of the application. So I'll pull them in for, like, one-on-one conversations and get their thoughts and then do... just include that as part of like the discovery work that we're doing for the solutions design. And so when we get to those refinement meetings, which are, you know, one designer, 8-10 developers, it's a little bit less intimidating because I've already had conversations with several of them outside of it, and B, you know, I already know where some of like the tricky parts are and how we can answer some of those questions.
Gotcha. So you're taming the lions before throwing in the gazelle.
Yeah. Yeah. For example, we're building a flow where we found out that people like to gift to themselves. So we're trying to test the waters and see if there's like a world in where you can gift to you can change your flow and gift to yourself. And one of our designers, Paul, created these wireframes, and they're just concepts right now. And we threw them to two developers in a small session, and they were like, "Ooh, I'm concerned about this, and I'm concerned about that. And what happens if the store wants something, but we don't have it?" And it was really eye-opener because some of the things that we thought we were doing because we didn't want to introduce a lot of work, we were actually making it more complicated than if we had done the ideal experience. So that was like a case where as designers, we were putting shackles on ourselves when actually the better experience was easier to build. And so I think after that call this week, everybody left and we were all very happy because the developers were like, "Yeah, we made it easier." And as designers, we were like, "Yeah, we made it nicer." And so it was like a really good conversation.
Yeah.
I'll let you know
That's
if it gets
spilled.
A rare
win-win situation between engineer and designer.
Yeah.
So we're coming up on time, and I'd love to hear from you, like, where do you see the future of collaboration going with teams becoming more remote, with companies incorporating more user experience into their priority?
Yeah, and I think the answer here is going to be a little bit surprising, but one of the things that I think has helped a lot with collaboration is the design system that we use at Loop. It has forced designers to have a common language and to have a set of things that they need to work with, like building blocks. And so that makes it easier to onboard people. It makes it easier to bring into the team. It's easier to get started and work. So we're currently in the process of trying to like document everything that has been built. But then that also helps collaboration with development because, you know, you can say, "Oh, these are these components and this is how it's supposed to work." Whereas before it was like, what is this the right font size? Is this the right color? Is it now it's more like, okay, let's put together the Lego blocks of what something that we've already built. And I think that has really helped, you know, elevate the conversation. Right now we're talking, whenever we do design reviews, which we do all remote, before we would go into like the really tiny minutia, and we would have to be like, oh, how does this drop down behave when I expand it, and how does it look? And you know, I can tell you, Ginny, I think we spent like 2 weeks on drop downs, just like for building that design system. And it's really tiring when you're doing that remotely, because before you would just like grab a whiteboard and you'd like sketch it out and you'd be like, okay, that sort of works and that's it. But when you're remote, you know, people speak over each other and you're like, but what happens if we do this and what happens if we do that? But now that we have those blocks built together, our meetings are more like, is this the right flow? Should we put these two components together? And that's a lot easier to do remote, right? Mm-hmm. We're speaking high level instead of low level, and everybody knows like the rules of play. So it's like before we were inventing basketball, and now we're just playing, and it's a lot easier to do one remotely. And if you have like a good set of guidelines, it becomes a lot fluid, and reviews have become a lot fluid. The other thing that we're trying to use is branching in Figma. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to test it out.
Could you explain that to the audience?
Yeah. So branching in Figma. So it's like if you have a tree and you start like creating branches of a design. So like variations on a design. And some of those branches are going to get pruned and some of them are going to get merged back into the trunk. Right. And so what Figma allows us to do is whenever we're doing explorations, one of our designers is able to create this branch, create the changes that they want, and then ask to merge it back into the tree or bring it back into the like the source of truth, how we like to call it. And what they'll do is they'll be able to request people for review. And so this is all done asynchronously. And so we'll have one or two of our designers go in, look at it, review it, make notes, and then approve it or not approve it. And so a lot of that is being done asynchronously, and so our design reviews have gotten out of the weeds. We're still not great at it. We still have a lot of Figma files everywhere, and not all of the designers are using branches, and sometimes, you know, priorities are approving sessions are not great. People have to be reminded, but it's really helped us, you know, being able to keep track of what changes were made and being able to review them remotely. That's really helped for collaboration. And the other thing that I think has helped really in collaboration with the design team is we're following an agile process. So we're doing sprints in design, we're doing refinements of design tickets, and we're also doing retros within our team. And you know, it's not perfect. Collaborating remotely is not the same as being in the office, but I do feel like we've built a pretty good design team that has some rapport, even across time and across distance.
Yeah, no, those are great advice. So basically, one, be sure to invest into building a design system, trying out branching on Figma. And then the third aspect is
having a process.
Third is having a process. Yeah. Cool. Well, we're right up on time. Do you have any other advice or recommendations for our audience today, Ariana?
No, I mean, just ending right with the thing that's the most important, which is the human that has to deal with whatever you design. if you forget that sometimes you can be so invested in getting those designs out or, you know, making that conversion or generating something new that you forget there's an actual human being at the end of your products. And that's who we should be always focused on.
Of course. And not just the users too, but the people that you're working with as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mariana. If people wanted to connect with you, what is the best way for them to reach you at?
You can always contact me on Instagram or on Twitter. My handle is NanaLQ. So it's
awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much, Mariana. Really appreciate your time. If anyone has questions regarding design process and how to build out a good working balance between engineering, research, and design, you can always reach out to Mariana with your questions. Awesome. We loved having you on the show. Thank you so much, Mariana.
Thank you. Thanks, Jenny.
All right. Take care.